The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the books section of the January 22, 2024 issue of the New Yorker. Trials of the Witchy Women. Across seven centuries, women have been accused of witchcraft, but what that means often differs wildly, revealing the anxieties of each particular society. By Rivka Galkin. In 1532, when the Constitutio Criminalis Carolina became the law of the Holy Roman Empire, it specified that witchcraft was a heinous crime, punishable by execution by fire. The Carolina was often cited in the European witch trials that followed, with crazes peaking in the second half of the 16th century and again in the early decades of the 17th century. In Germany alone, 25,000 people were executed. The Carolina is sometimes called the basis for these witch hunts, but it can also be seen as an attempt to tame them. Previously, trials could proceed on the allegations of only one accuser. The new set of laws required two. The accusers had to be deemed credible, and they could not be paid or of evil repute. There also had to be sufficient indication of sorcery for the accused to be tortured. The Carolina was an improvement over trial by ordeal, which for centuries had been a fairly standard practice. In one common example, a suspected witch was forced to hold a burning iron. How quickly God healed the wound was the measure by which the accused was declared innocent or guilty. In 1597, King James VI of Scotland, he later became King James I of England and of the Bible, wrote Daemonology, in which he enthusiastically embraced witch hunting. His ideas were not aligned with those behind the Carolina. He remained faithful to the floating ordeal, tossing suspects into the sea where only the innocent presumably would sink. He described it as perfect because water shall refuse to receive them in her bosom that have shaken off them the sacred water of baptism. Drowning was reserved for the saved. Compared with such ordeals, the Carolina begins to look progressive. It connects to the dream that the law, if written well, can save us from our worst selves, that it can temper passion with reason and reduce violence rather than codify it. Though things don't always work out that way. Marion Gibson, a professor of Renaissance and magical literature at the University of Exeter, has now written 8 books on the subject of witches, including Witchcraft Myths in American Culture and Witchcraft the Basics. Her 8th book, Witchcraft, A History in 13 Trials, published by Scribner, traverses 7 centuries and several continents. There's the trial of a Sami woman, Carrie, in 17th century Finnmark, of a young religious zealot named Marie-Catherine Cadier in 18th century France, and of a 20th century politician, Bereng Leortoli, in Basutoland, in present-day Lesotho. The experiences of the accused women and a few accused men are foregrounded through novelistic descriptions of their lives before and after the persecution. Gibson describes, for example, Joan Wright working in the cold hush of her employer's dairy, churning milk so that fat globules rupture and coalesce in the near magical transformation of cream into butter. The inevitable charisma of villainy makes the accusers vivid as well. The character that I found myself following most attentively, however, is also the book's through line, The Trial. The Return of Martin Guerre by Natalie Zeman Davis is built around the historical trial of Arnaud Dutille, who for years successfully pretended to be the peasant Martin Guerre. The peasants, more than 90% of whom could not write in the 16th century, have left us few documents of self-revelation, Davis writes. But there exists another set of sources in which peasants are found in many predicaments. It is in court cases that we can catch sight of the hopes and emotions and fears of those who leave no other written record. The trials of the accused people in witchcraft return to us in detail, lives about which we might otherwise know nothing. In what ways have varying legal codes and trial procedures altered the destinies of those accused of witchcraft? Although 13 trials can't decide the question, the book does put it on the stand. Gibson shows us church courts, state courts, colonial courts, assize courts, and improvised court systems used in the chaos of a civil war, and there are judging panels of 3 and judging panels of 25. And historically, there were no judges or jurors who were women. There are also the kinds of trial that happen outside a courtroom, trials by poison, and King James' favored trial by swim. To wager on the outcome of these various trials is not as easy as you might think. They always seem to be hurrying to doom, but they occasionally don't get there. In 1645, in Manningtree, England, a tailor goes to a diviner because his wife is having violent fits that are, he says, more than merely natural. The diviner confirms the man's fears. Two women have bewitched his wife. This is how Bess Clark, a one-legged, unmarried woman, came to be arrested and tried. Clark's mother had also been tried as a witch years earlier and executed. At the time of Clark's trial, the English Civil War had left the court system in disarray. Rather than being tried in an assize court, whose judges tended not to be very religious, Clark was tried by a presiding judge who was a strict Puritan, a slave trafficker, and a notoriously cruel admiral. Clark faced a procedure called watching and walking. She was made to walk continuously around in her cell for 4 days, while observers noted whether any of her animal familiars or other devilish alliances came by to consult with her. After Clark became exhausted, she told her watchers that if they would sit down with her, she would introduce them to her spirit animals. The watchers reported seeing several familiars, including a short-legged and plump imp-like unto a dog that was white with sandy spots. One watcher said that this dog was the first spirit animal to appear, while another said that the first was a white cat named Holt. There was also a long-legged greyhound named Vinegar Tom, a black rabbit called Sack and Sugar, and a polecat. The animals were seen vanishing and transforming, and Clark, in supplying her persecutors with the story of her seduction by Satan, said that they had been born from a fall into sin. Clark is said to have referred to all the spirit animals as her children, and she did have a child at home, Jane, whom she had had baptized, and whose father had not married her. In the ensuing trial, Clark was not allowed representation, and her accusers were not cross-examined. The jury delivered a guilty verdict within minutes. She was sent to the gallows. Another convicted woman died while waiting in line to be hanged, perhaps from a heart attack. This did not stop the proceedings, and Clark was killed that day. What kinds of crime did people need to ascribe to witches? The Carolina punished only crimes that had caused others damage, but many women were charged with less tangible evils, such as attending a witch's Sabbath or changing form. Some witches were said to have cursed brides, some to have caused storms to sink ships, some to have sailed to sea in a sieve, and quite a few to have affected the death of a baby. In a 1591 treatise, Johann Georg Gudelmann, a legal scholar who favored the regulations of the Carolina, and thus can be seen as a relatively progressive for a witch expert of that time, argued that controlling the weather was not a real phenomenon and therefore could not be the basis for legal questioning. He worked to separate people who had delusions but were not actually witches from what he saw as quite a small number of people who really did perpetrate evil, who really had made pacts with the devil. Torture produced wild tales of evil, of course, but even the monstrous and incredible forced confessions were often still personal. The accused sometimes told of what had really happened to them indirectly. Carrie, the Sami woman, who was tried in Finnmark in a Danish colonial court, described the devil taking the form not of a local animal, such as a reindeer, but of a goat, a non-native animal associated with the colonizer. When Bess Clark confessed to having sex with the devil, her description of him was reminiscent of the man who had impregnated her. Tatabi, an enslaved woman in Salem, Massachusetts, depicted in The Crucible by Arthur Miller, was accused of bewitching two young girls. When pressed under torture to name her collaborators, she described one as a tall man of Boston in fancy clothes. She also said the other witches told her that if she didn't do what they said, they would hurt her, or even that her head would be cut off. Tatabi had most likely been sold into slavery as a child and sent to a plantation before spending a decade in Boston. She populated her confession with descriptions of people and situations we assume she encountered in her real life. One can also glimpse the fears of the persecutors and the confessions they forced out of the accused. Consider the witchery accusations made by King James. His mother, Mary, Queen of Scots, was said to have been involved in the murder of her second husband, James's father. Later, James's foster father was poisoned. Then his successor was executed. And then the next successor was accused of seducing the young king when he was a teenager. In 1587, Mary was executed, and in 1590, James instigated a witch trial against a healer named Agnes Sampson, accusing her of trying to murder him and his Danish bride by causing storms to sink their ships. In James's mind, the evil forces in the world were set on his murder. Eventually, Sampson confessed to collaborating with witches from Copenhagen, attending a series of meetings planning his destruction, being present on his wedding night, and having attended a witch's Sabbath in which she and a circle of witches passed around a waxen figure of him, which they then gave to Satan. It's as if James and Samson became a storytelling duo conceived in hell. In one witch trial under James, the jury acquitted the accused. So James put the jury members on trial until they agreed to change their ruling. Other courts were less kangaroo. Gibson illustrates one in the opening chapter. The setting is Innsbruck, Austria, in 1485, a time when the power balance between the Pope and the Archduke of Austria is stable but uneasy. An inquisitor named Heinrich Kramer arrives with paperwork from the Pope, allowing him to set up an inquisition to root out witches. He gives sermons decrying the murderous witches all around and exhorts the townspeople to be vigilant in reporting any witchy activity. He also keeps track of who attends his services. The local authorities aren't pleased to have Kramer there, but they can't dismiss him, not with his papal paperwork. One day, Helena Schulbrunn, a confident and outspoken woman, passes Kramer on the street and says to him what lots of Innsbruckers were likely thinking, "You lousy monk! I hope you get the falling sickness." Other accounts report that she said, "When will the devil take you away?" Kramer initiates an investigation of Schubert, who not only hasn't been attending his services, but has also been heard to say that demonology is heresy. Schubert has accumulated a few enemies over the years. She attended the wedding of a suitor she had rejected, and the man's wife says that she hasn't felt well since then. There's also the family of a knight she is said to have had an affair with. He died young, not long after the affair, and his relatives are suspicious. Kramer puts together a case against Schubert and six other people. He declares himself the judge, but the local authorities intervene and insist on the bishops hearing the case. The accused are jailed. The wheels of injustice turn. A big crowd attends the trial. In court, Schubert initially says that she won't swear on the Bible. Some Catholics viewed the use of holy objects in that way to be heretical. Kramer proceeds with his questioning. Soon, the subject of inquiry turns away from witchcraft. "Are you of a good life?" he asked her. "Yes," she said. "Were you a virgin at the time of your marriage?" Schubert refuses to answer. After what was likely a suspenseful silence, the bishop's representative intervenes. The sex lives of Innsbruckers are, he says, secret matters that hardly concern the case. Kramer is out of step with the norms of the area. The mood has palpably changed. An expert lawyer from out of town, Johann Minhart of Wemding, announces that he will be representing the accused, all seven of them. Minhart challenges Kramer's paperwork, which is in disarray. It's the sunny, adverse side of a bureaucratic nightmare. By the end of the day, the accused are released and Kramer is under investigation. The Witchcraft Act of 1735 was England's effort to put a halt to witch hunting. It made it illegal to claim that there were people with magical powers and illegal to accuse someone of being a witch, a thing that enough people in power had decided did not exist. Science was beginning to tell different stories about the world. There were fewer kings and more parliaments, and the influence of the church was diminishing. There was one holdout among high-ranking officials to the Witchcraft Act, James Erskine, who is also notable for having arranged for his wife to be abducted and brought to a distant island so that she could be pronounced dead. Erskine held a big public funeral for her. The act precipitated a shift from prosecuting people as witches to prosecuting people who presented themselves as witches or as magical in some way. Often enough, this meant putting the same sorts of people, women making money as healers or diviners, or colonized people whose local belief systems were frightening to the colonizers, on trial. Gibson tells the story of Nellie Duncan, a woman born into a puritanical family in Scotland in 1897, who later became a spiritualist. She chaired News of the Dead, coughed up ectoplasm, typically muslin, and ventriloquized, so that the cabinets appeared to contain speaking mediums. In the years after the First World War, demand for such services was high. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle regularly consulted with a spirit named Phineas via his second wife, Jean Leckie, who was also a spiritualist. Unlike Leckie, Duncan was, by the age of 16, an unwed mother. She was kicked out of her family home and worked in a factory before marrying a cabinet maker and having seven more children. Duncan had lung and kidney infections, and her husband had had a heart attack and a nervous breakdown. So she went back to work, this time at a bleaching plant, with shifts that ran from 5 a.m. to 2 p.m. When she got home, she did mending and laundry work to make additional money. But then Duncan's religious upbringing came to help her in an unexpected way. Even as a child, she had seen ghosts and had prophetic dreams. As an adult, she realized that she could channel spirit energies, absorb the illnesses of others, and predict deaths, even distant ones. Her beliefs weren't all that eccentric. Gibson cites a survey indicating that 35% of British people thought such contact with the dead was possible. Duncan joined a spiritualist church, traveled to Edinburgh and London, and eventually began to make a pretty good living. Her seances were not cheap. She could channel spirits in Welsh, German, Gaelic, French, and even Yanito, a vernacular language from Gibraltar. Sure, she had made an error here and there about people's sons in the army and whether or not and how they died, but she had also foreseen, or at least known about before it was announced to the public, the 1941 sinking of a British military ship. In 1944, under the Witchcraft Act, she was charged with pretending to conjure spirits of dead people. A spiritualist society provided her with an attorney whose strategy was an odd one. He called his client, quote, a big fat woman and a nobody, end quote, and he said that he considered all his clients to be, quote, unimportant people, end quote, who were illustrations of what was important, that spiritualism was true. The defense failed. Duncan was sentenced to 9 months in prison. But supporters of spiritualism and of Duncan called her the last witch to emphasize what they saw as a miscarriage of justice. Winston Churchill described the decision to prosecute Duncan as obsolete Tom foolery. By 1951, the Witchcraft Act had been repealed and replaced with laws persecuting deliberately fraudulent mediums, sparing true believers. This law itself was repealed in 2008. Gibson uses Duncan's story to illustrate shifts in how the idea of witches and of witch hunting, and more rarely a belief in actual witches, persists in more recent times. By the late 19th century, the supposed enemies might be spiritualists, anarchists, communists, suffragists, or homosexual people. In the 20th century, civil rights campaigners and anti-colonial nationalists join the list. If Gibson is perhaps at times fitting witches to her own vision, she is not alone in that. She tells a compelling story about La Sorcière, a now mostly discredited study of witch trials by the 19th century French historian Jules Michelet, who sometimes collaborated with his wife, Athenaeus. In Gibson's eyes, La Sorcière argues that French witches of the past were, quote, revolutionary pagan priestesses, healers and mesmerists, sexually liberated and in touch with an old deity wrongly demonized as satanic, end quote. The Michelets identified as pantheists. They made the witches of the past into their own likenesses. Saying witches through the Michelets lens is comforting, even moving, but it also feels not only incorrect but wrong. There are ways of valuing these accused witches without asserting that they were heroes and rebels who embodied our beliefs. Perhaps our fascination with witch trials is more about imagining our own trials. Somebody must have made a false accusation against Joseph K., for he was arrested one morning without having done anything wrong, begins one of literature's most famous stories about a trial. In Kafka's novel, Joseph K.'s experience is nightmarish, but the courtroom is in the attic of his own residence. To my mind, there is an element of wish fulfillment in the trial, a dream of being heard or watched, or a profound interest to someone. Even a malevolent, irrational force will do. In many an imagination, trials are about being heard, being exonerated. We see this in phrases such as having your day in court. Many first-person novels read like pleas made to an imagined court, one of public or of godly opinion. In the story within Kafka's trial, which is often excerpted as before the law, a man spends year after year at the door of the law, which is guarded by a gatekeeper. The man is waiting to gain entrance. Near the end of his life, old and frail, the man asks the gatekeeper a question. Why haven't more people sought entrance at the door of the law? He's been the only one there over all these years. The gatekeeper responds that it's because that door is for him alone, and now the gatekeeper can shut it. And now from the January 14th, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker, Dixon Despommier wants our cities to be like forests. A leading proponent of vertical farming discusses how urban areas should adapt to a perilous environmental future. By Jean Michaud. In the year 2000, Dixon D. Despommier, then a professor of public health and microbiology at Columbia University, was teaching a class on medical ecology in which he asked his students, what will the world be like in 2050? And a follow-up, what would you like the world to be like in 2050? As Despommier told the New Yorker's Ian Frazier in 2017, his students decided that by 2050, the planet will be really crowded with 8 or 9 billion people, and they wanted New York City to be able to feed its population entirely on crops grown within its own geographic limit. The class had calculated that by farming every square foot of rooftop space in the city, you could provide enough calories to feed only about 2% of the 2050 population of New York. Urban farming was a good idea, Despommier thought, but his students hadn't taken it far enough. What's wrong with putting the farmer inside the building, he asked them. remembering that at the time there were hundreds to perhaps thousands of empty buildings in New York City. Throughout the next decade, as he continued to teach the class, Despommier and his students developed this idea, including the use of cultivation techniques that required little or no soil, culminating in the 2010 book, The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. The concept proved popular and has been widely implemented. There are now more than 2,000 vertical farms in the U.S. alone, with a market value estimated at $5.6 billion in 2022. Though retired from full-time teaching, Despommier is still thinking about ecological problems. His latest book, The New City, How to Build Our Sustainable Urban Future, which evolved from a course that Despommier taught at Fordham University, is a manifesto for the future of cities on a warming planet. As Despommier notes, the world's cities make up 2% of the Earth's surface, but produce 60% of the planet's greenhouse emissions. And cities are likely to continue growing. It is estimated that by the middle of this century, 68% of the world's population will live in urban areas, up from 57% in 2021. Last summer's seemingly endless wildfires and extreme heat events have made Despommier's ideas seem especially urgent. On a recent morning, I spoke with him over Zoom, where he joined from his apartment in Fort Lee, New Jersey. At 83, he remains a lively, charismatic presence, even on screen, punctuating his answers with dramatic hand gestures, rhetorical questions, punning asides, and laughter. Our conversation has been condensed and edited for clarity. Question. Vertical farms and other forms of urban agriculture are one of the pillars of this vision you're putting forward for transforming the way cities are built and managed. Another pillar is the idea that cities should be constructed from wood. It seems counterintuitive to build a city out of wood when we have a deforestation problem. Why is it important to build cities out of wood? Trees sequester carbon, harvest water, produce food, and convert sunlight into energy. Those are the four characteristics I would love a city to have. The resiliency of forests is to be emulated, and that's the reason why I picked forest as my biomimic. I want my city to be as resilient as Earth's hardwood forests. The main reason why deforestation is occurring is to make room for farms. Before there was farming, which was about 10 to 12,000 years ago, we had 6 trillion trees. We now have 3 trillion trees. We've cut down half of the Earth's ability to capture carbon. We're not going to replace all of that with new trees. But if we got back up to 5 trillion trees, let's say, simply by leaving the remaining forests alone and letting them repopulate and selectively harvesting, the Earth's temperature rise would begin to slow down. And once you slowed it down, that gives you time to reflect and to prepare for these changes that are not going to go away. Replacing the 3 trillion trees by planting them, that's not going to work. We'll never be able to do that. So we have to let nature do that part. And in order to do that part, we have to return a lot of farmland back to what it used to be, which was forests. A scientist named Gene Lichen studied what happens to a forest when you cut it down. All of it. You don't do anything. You leave it all in place and just watch it regrow. He started those experiments in the 1960s in New Hampshire, a place called Hubbard Brook. Hubbard Brook has been continuously studied since then for how trees and how a forest recovers from a catastrophic event like clear cutting. If you look at what happened when Mount St. Helens blew, it's almost the same thing. The great majority of the trees got knocked down by the shockwave from the explosion. If you go online and look at Mount St. Helens today, you wouldn't recognize it. Actually, you would. It looks like the old Mount St. Helens. So that's only 40 years from a catastrophic event back to a harvestable forest. Question. There's a history of fires burning down cities such as London and Chicago. And this summer we've seen the devastating Canadian wildfires. Why build out of wood when it is more susceptible to fire and decay than other construction materials? Yeah, like concrete and steel, for instance. The concrete and steel industries have huge carbon footprints. It takes a lot of energy to make those things. There's a tremendous release of CO2 in making concrete, and there's a tremendous CO2 release by melting iron to make an I-beam. And once you've made the I-beam is good for only one thing, and that's the building that it was measured for. If you want to use it for something else, you'll probably have to melt it down and throw it into another mold. The point is that you're using a lot of energy this way, right? Let's go back to the forest. When a forest catches fire, burns, and then the fire goes out, what do you see? Do you see an absolutely leveled plain with nothing on it? Or do you see the remnants of the forest, the trunks of the trees, which are still there? Why is that trunk still standing? That's wood, right? And it didn't burn to the ground. There's a good reason for that. The trunk is made out of very dense packed lignin and cellulose. Those are the two components of wood. The inner core of a tree is not alive. It's like a coral reef, and the tree grows out from that core. It's so dense that the oxygen can't get out to the rest of the lignin and the cellulose. Now, what if we could make a wood product that had the same characteristics? Thank God for an Austrian researcher named Gerhard Schickhofer, who in the 1990s began developing a wood product that imitates the remnant of a forest fire. That's called cross-laminated timber, CLT for short. If you go online and look up cross-laminated timber, your eyes will pop at all of the buildings that are now being made out of it. It's actually stronger than concrete and steel. It's stronger, lighter, easier to manipulate, and to repurpose. You can repurpose this stuff almost instantly. You can just take it down like it was a Lego set. Next question. You make the point that cities are only going to grow. If so, we're going to need to build more large buildings. Can this kind of wood be adapted for constructing tall buildings? Well, in the book, I have a quote from one builder saying that there is no limit to the height of which you can make a cross-laminated timber building. And the trees that we're talking about here are not greater in diameter than 9 inches. That's the ideal size for a tree to turn into a cross-laminated timber building. Question. How long does it take to grow a tree from a seedling to 9 inches? 20 years. If you look at New York City in the year 1900 and then look at the year 2023 and do a building-for-building count, how many buildings do you think are present in 2023 that were present in 1900? A small number, I bet. It's a very small number. It's about 20%. Major metropolitan areas tend to turn over, so to speak. The buildings turn over as new technology comes online for heating, for electrical, for safety, for transportation. Those old buildings have to be scrapped, right? There's a hole in the ground, and next thing you know, there's a brand new building. It sounds like we'll be using up all the wood, but the fact is that if vertical farming succeeds, there'll be a lot more land to grow trees. That's the built-in safety valve that we can take advantage of to have a completely renewable resource of building material that also captures carbon. There's no other material like that. If we value it enough, we will make sure that it's economically feasible to do that. The clear-cut model didn't work, and it actually wrecked other industries. But we can still have a managed forest, though it's managed for biodiversity now. Not only does the tree that you've used for the cross-laminated timber capture carbon, but the tree that grows up in place of the tree that you just took out, that's another source of carbon capture. So you've doubled your carbon sink in 20 years, basically. Question. The two other pillars of your manifesto for the new city are renewable energy and harvesting water from the air. I think that most people are familiar with the renewable energy sources that you discuss, such as wind, solar, and geothermal. But perhaps you should talk about your proposals for cities harvesting water from the air. Okay, let's take a plane to Bermuda. 63,000 people living in an archipelago in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean with very little groundwater. They live on a coral atoll. So there's nowhere for the water to collect. They live almost exclusively off of rainwater. How do they do that? They have a roof on every building that, if you look at it from the top, looks like a spiral that finally ends up in one of the corners of the building. A gutter system collects the water. Water circulates down into the cistern. That's 63,000 people. And the reward is you don't need a centralized water system. Now let's take New York City, which on average gets 47 inches of rain per year. The total square footage of New York's footprint is 300 square miles. How much rain a year in gallons do you think 47 inches of rain in a 300 square mile area represents? The city would gain 271 billion gallons of fresh water if it could harvest every drop of rain that fell on New York. No place, not even Bermuda, harvests every drop of rain. If you get a very heavy rainstorm, those roofs are inefficient in collecting all the water, and that falls on them. These roofs would have to be redesigned for urban areas that have the option of taking every rooftop and turning it into a rain collection device. New York City would never, ever have a water shortage again, no matter what. So that's one source of water that every city with 20 inches of rain or more per year would benefit from. There are some cities, of course, where it doesn't rain as much as that, so you have to rely on other ways of harvesting water from the air. And one of them is harvesting from fog. They have devices that look like nets on poles, and if you look closely at the net, it's a collection of water droplets. All of those droplets filter down into a collection device, and eventually you've got big buckets of water. You can supply a whole village like that. There are some cities in China that could harvest over 1 trillion gallons of water per year. Huge cities like Shanghai, for instance, and Beijing. Those cities have frequent water shortages. What if every building were designed in a way that it could harvest all the water that fell on that building? Foster and Partners, a large architectural firm in London, has already done it. Question. What about desert cities like Phoenix? The state of Arizona recently announced that it would limit building permits for new construction that relies on groundwater. How do desert cities harvest water from the air? Well, the air, no matter where you go, has got some humidity factor associated with it, even though the humidity might be low. There's still water in the air that you can harvest if you know how to do it. So no matter where you are, there will always be some water to collect. But the argument could be made that there isn't enough water, that even if you did it every day and every building did it, you still might not have enough. Okay. But they get an annual monsoon in Phoenix, right? Just plan for it. You could design something for a roof that would fold out of sight when you're not using it, and when you want it, it comes up and forms a tent-like affair. When it rains, all the water collects in the middle and is stored in a cistern. If you value water, you will do that. And if you don't value water, then you'll never have enough water to satisfy you. There is one more major resource of water that we're not talking about, and that is reuse of wastewater. How much water per day does the New York City consume from its five main reservoirs in New York State? 1.2 billion gallons of water per day. So over 8 million people, 1.2 billion gallons per day. And then how much water do you think New York City discards per day? Wastewater. More than a billion gallons. And we don't use one drop of that water. If you could recover 1.2 billion gallons of water a day and you drink 1.2 billion gallons a day, well, that's a zero-sum equation. Why don't we do that? Question. We've outlined a number of your proposals. I want to discuss going from proposal to enacting some of these ideas. There's an existing set of government officials and real estate developers and construction companies that control the construction of new buildings. How are you going to get them to buy into these ideas and start adopting some of these practices? Well, if you put the burden of proof on my shoulders only, I think it will fail. Because I'm now 83 years old and I don't think I can spend the rest of my life going around the city councils preaching the gospel. Fortunately, and I mean really fortunately, there are lots of people out there who are already doing that. One of them is William McDonough, an architect and designer who designs buildings made out of cross-laminated timber. Michael Green has a TED Talk, Why We Should Build Wooden Skyscrapers, that's really worth going to listen to. In his TED Talk, he basically says, I am a citizen of Earth, just like you are. He says, I would like to see this place getting better, and here's how to make it better. This will not happen overnight. We've gone through 10,000 years with agriculture as the driving force in modernizing humanity. We've invented mathematics and astronomy, language and music and art and society. It's going to take another 100 to 200 years, I think, before everybody says enough is enough. You know, if 10% of my population dies every year from heat stroke, or if they die from starvation, or if they die from water deprivation, or if they die from some disease that's only transmitted at that particular temperature, like, for instance, malaria, eventually everybody will say, wait a minute, this thing really is real. It can be addressed. Question. Underlying your proposal is the goal of environmental justice, creating a city where under-resourced neighborhoods no longer bear the brunt of climate impacts. However, economic inequality is pretty well entrenched in most cities in the world. Doesn't it seem likely that the privileged will continue to hoard resources and not share them with the less fortunate? Well, the answer is yes, of course. You can't outlaw greed. But if you live in a building that produces its own food, harvests its own water, and generates its own energy, there is a minimum good standard of living. That is a city that starts out by design to exclude poverty. If every building is designed to be independent of every other building, that's the beauty of being off the food grid and off the water grid and off the energy grid. If you can create an environment that allows that to happen, you've got yourself a hardwood forest of buildings. They refer to New York City as a forest of skyscrapers. Wouldn't it be ironic, eventually, if it were a forest of wooden skyscrapers? Question. Your book features satellite photos of large cities at night. The pictures in the book made me think of the scene from the movie The Matrix, in which Agent Smith, who's basically a piece of machine code, describes human beings as a virus and a plague, noting that other mammals are able to live in balance with their surrounding environment, while mankind seems unable to do that. As someone whose academic career was built on the study of parasites, what do you think of this idea? Cities to the planet are parasitic. It seems to me that we are genetically programmed, like honeybees are genetically programmed, like ants and termites are genetically programmed, to construct houses that reflect our wants and needs. And humans, once they discovered the virtue of the city, the first thing that popped into their mind was, I can get rich. I can exploit a collection of people to allow me to accumulate their wealth. If you look at virtually every city, you'll see what the center of the city is all about. It's about wealth. And it's about commerce. And it's about the accumulation of wealth, not just by individuals, but also by cities. I mean, a city can become wealthy also, and it can share that wealth. And people living in that city can benefit from that. That's the way we're programmed. My biggest gripe about urbanization is it's essentially unplanned except for one thing, commerce. That's planned. Poverty is a design issue. It's a failure to accommodate everybody. By design, cities should include every single individual who lives there. What I would like is the framework of the city, at least, to reflect a respect for both the city and the natural environment. The real undercurrent of this is that if you don't think integrating human activities with a compatible natural landscape is important, just keep doing what you're doing. You'll see the result. You'll find out what the natural world actually does for you, but it'll be too late. It'll be gone. And when that happens, we will be gone. Next, from the under review section of the January 12th, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker, Milton Friedman, the prize fighter. The Economist's lifelong pugilism wasn't in spite of his success. It may have been the key to it. By Krithika Vadagur. In 2002, 3 months after Milton Friedman turned 90, a celebratory conference was convened at the school that had become synonymous with his ideas. Ben Bernanke, then a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, delivered a talk at the University of Chicago on depression and recovery. It had been 39 years since Friedman published A Monetary History of the United States, his blockbuster account of how the Fed's missteps caused the Great Depression, and 25 years since he won the Nobel Prize. After Bernanke gave an encomium to Friedman's long and storied career, he was moved to add a flourish, quote, abusing slightly my status as an official representative of the Federal Reserve, end quote. Regarding the Great Depression, he told Friedman, you're right, we did it, we're very sorry, but thanks to you, we won't do it again. It was an extraordinary statement from a leader of the Fed, which Friedman had spent his entire career critiquing. In Bernanke's retelling, Friedman's once outre argument that the Fed should have aggressively expanded the money supply when people pulled money from banks in 1929 was now practically common sense. The hyperbolic praise from Bernanke, a future Fed chairman, epitomized Friedman's stature as perhaps the most influential economist of the late 20th century. But Milton Friedman was never one for victory laps. He spent the final years of his life mostly complaining in just about any forum that would have him. In a report published earlier that year, he lamented that the U.S. was a, quote, nearly 40% enslaved state, end quote, because of outsized taxation. In 2004, he told Investors Business Daily that the extremely low interest rates of the new millennium were fundamentally an indication of something wrong. And just a year before his death, in 2006, he bemoaned the rise of the euro, a big source of problems, not a source of help, and disparaged Social Security as a Ponzi scheme. His lifelong pugilism didn't persist in spite of his unprecedented success. It may have been the key to it. That's the emergent lesson of Milton Friedman, The Last Conservative, a new intellectual biography by the Stanford historian Jennifer Burns. Burns, a fellow at the Hoover Institution, now home to Friedman's papers, spent nearly a decade combing through his syllabi, correspondence, drafts, and notes to produce, quote, the first full-length biography of Friedman based upon archival research, end quote. Despite considerable access to sources and even Friedman's children, Burns never quite pulls back the veil on her subject psychology. But her exhaustive account of Friedman's underdog decades does illuminate how the field of economics slowly polarized around his work. Friedman's influence is so pervasive today that it can be hard to unpack. His prescriptions informed everything from the end of the mandatory draft to the earned income tax credit, and his theories transformed the economic policies of the U.S. and U.K. in the last quarter of the 20th century. His extreme conception of free markets also influenced many developing countries' economies during and after the Cold War, often with a mixed legacy of growth and austerity. The way he accomplished all this and more, per Burns' account, was by picking ever larger fights. In the course of the book, the diminutive economist, who stood just over 5 feet tall, comes to seem like nothing so much as a welterweight boxer. The son of Jewish immigrants to central New Jersey, Friedman started his Ph.D. in Chicago in 1932, 3 years into the Great Depression. He had attended Rutgers on a scholarship and planned to become an actuary, but failed the exams and switched his major to economics. That's how he met Arthur Burns, another future chairman of the Federal Reserve, but at the time a 27-year-old graduate student teaching a class on business cycles. Arthur Burns introduced Friedman to Principles of Economics, the seminal 1890 textbook by the British economist Alfred Marshall, which turned Friedman onto economics' potential to answer society's biggest questions. According to Marshall, prices could help explain almost anything, supply, demand, the impact of economic policies, the allocation of resources to the effects of negative externalities, such as waste products. Friedman declined a graduate offer in mathematics to start a PhD in Chicago's economics department. It was not without risk, because economics had not yet become what Burns calls the master discipline of the 20th century. The Depression had thrown the field into crisis, and only years later would professional economists become really ensconced in government. Friedman's professors in Chicago were notable iconoclasts, including Frank Knight, a theorist of risk and a crusading anti-socialist, and Jacob Viner, a professor of price theory and an early critic of the Fed. The variant of price theory taught at Chicago was so idiosyncratic that Burns refers to it as revealed truth and its students as converted. In Viner's course, Friedman sat next to one of his few female classmates, Rose Director, whom he married 5 years later. He arrived at just the right time for the conversion experience of Chicago price theory, which emphasized free markets and pointed skepticism of government regulation. Friedman soon fell in with students who were passionately critical of the fledgling New Deal. They gathered in a dusty storeroom dubbed Room 7 to pore over Knight's lectures, and Friedman also read more broadly from the classical liberal canon. He quickly grasped even wider implications for price theory than what he was being taught. Starting from an unassuming place, the quantity theory equation, which links the price level to the amount of money in the economy, he landed on the grander claim that every major inflation was produced by monetary expansion. And he zoned in on fighting inflation as the government's most important task to be carried out by its central bank. This emerging school of thought would be called monetarism. Monetarism was a direct challenge to New Deal liberalism, which prioritized employment over managing inflation. Thus, it also challenged the fiscal revolution of John Maynard Keynes, the British economist whose notions about government spending during recessions animated the New Deal, and who was, for many years, the most influential economist in the Anglo-American world. Keynes's Whiggish visions of less work and greater leisure was resonant during times of plenty, but it was vulnerable when inflation reared its head. Friedman's counter-revolution focused on an almost patronizingly simplistic directive for the government. Rather than underwrite a welfare state, just try to stabilize the money supply. At one point, he ballparked a whole number target for money supply growth, 4% per year. Burns writes as she arrived at her subtitle, The Last Conservative, with some trepidation after shooting down other potential labels like liberal, Friedman's own preference, though it also connotes the New Deal progressivism against which he crusaded, neoliberal, which Burns dismisses as academic jargon, and libertarian, never quite right since Friedman always pushed for a state management of the money supply. To Burns, Friedman was a conservative because his prescriptions were often based on historical analysis and because his career followed the arc of post-war American conservatism with its hybrid blend of libertarian economics, opposition to communism, and defense of traditional values and hierarchies. Her gesture towards a grand bygone era of both politics and economics is also a provocation. In recent years, that time has been eroded by a bipartisan assault on Friedman. This is an odd way for Burns to frame her project. Friedmanomics remains alive and well because Friedman's thought has been so broadly absorbed rather than attacked across the political spectrum. Friedman-inspired neoliberalism, as Burns herself writes, became truly powerful only when it captured the Democratic Party in the 1990s, exemplified by the 1992 election of the small government Democrat Bill Clinton. Indeed, despite the posthumous criticisms of Friedman's legacy that Burns painstakingly enumerates, his work still thoroughly shapes our lives. Pandemic-era stimulus checks channeled his concept of a helicopter drop of emergency payments, and inflation's rip-roaring return has reinvigorated talk of monetarism in many corners. But today, Friedman's once radical counsel to let unemployment rise through higher interest rates is the orthodox solution against which new ones are measured. Most striking is Burns' discussion of Cold War Chile, where Friedmanomics was exported in 1975. Since 1973, Chile had been run by Augusto Pinochet, a right-wing dictator who came to power through a U.S.-backed coup against the left-wing president Salvador Allende. Prices were, as Burns notes, rising more than 300% a year when a Santiago university called in Friedman and his colleagues. Friedman visited Chile in March 1975 and, in his own words, gave public lectures and seminars on inflation, talked to many citizens from many different walks of life, and met with numerous government officials, including General Pinochet. This became a liability the following year when the Pinochet connection dominated press coverage of Friedman's Nobel Prize. Burns doesn't dwell on the effects of Chicago school policies on Chileans, including widespread poverty and skyrocketing inequality, but does lament at some length how Friedman's brief meeting with Pinochet was blown up by a highly motivated, organized network, a sort of pre-Twitter mob of the global left, seizing upon a celebrity to gain greater visibility. This episode and Burns' treatment of it encapsulate the effects of a long-term trench mentality, both on the part of Friedman, who never really grappled with his policy's fallout. He maintained that Chile was an economic miracle, and of Burns, whose final chapters gloss over some of Friedman's worst ideas, like school vouchers, which legislatures weaponized to prolong segregation in the South. From 30,000 feet up, Burns writes of the 1970s, it was impossible to miss how monetarism had transformed not just the academic study of money, but the practices of central banking and the politics of inflation. End quote. Such a height also precludes this book from taking any meaningful stock of the millions who suffered because of Friedman's theories, from the unemployment of the Volcker shock to Margaret Thatcher's austerity revolution. That's a shame, because economics, still a master discipline of this century, owes its prestige precisely to its unique ability to influence millions of people's lives through theory. Many key economic storytellers of late have been heirs of Friedman, to the extent that economists, politicians, and journalists, and by extension many lay people, remain so concerned about inflation. Well, we've ran out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.